From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This is a special edition of Connections, broadcasting live from our WXXI television studios, devoting both hours of today's program to the opioid crisis in our community. Now, last hour, we heard some moving and inspiring stories of recovery. This hour, we welcome community leaders from various fields to discuss the state of the crisis here and the efforts to deal with it. It's a chance to understand what law enforcement is doing, as well as what the medical community is doing to provide treatment and a path to recovery. It is a complex problem that is certainly unfolding across the country, and we welcome the expertise of our guests for this hour. Dr. Michael Mendoza is Monroe County Commissioner of Public Health. Dr. Mendoza, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Jennifer Farringer, Director of DePaul's National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, Rochester area. Jennifer, welcome back to the program to you.
Thanks, Evan.
And Todd Baxter is the Monroe County Sheriff. Sheriff Baxter, and always nice to have you. Thanks for being here.
Good to be back. Thanks.
I want to mention that this broadcast is part of special programming in a series called New York's Opioid Crisis, which is airing on public broadcasting stations across the state next week. It's a first-of-its-kind partnership, drawing attention to the public health crisis and raising awareness of services available in local communities for those impacted by opioid addiction. You can hear coverage throughout next week on WXXI TV and WXXI Radio. If you'd like to join today's conversation on social media, you can tweet to us at Evan Dawson. That's me. Producer Megan Mack is at MMackMedia. We're using the hashtags AddictionCrisisPBS and OpioidCrisisNY. You can also watch video of the broadcast on Facebook Live right now. Just go to the WXXI News Facebook page, and you can watch it on our website, WXXINews.com. I want to start by asking our guests on stage what they made of the stories from last hour. And I'll start with Dr. Mendoza. What stands out to you?
Wow. Just wow.
Yeah.
You know, these are people who have shown such great strength and, you know, such an inspiration to the community. You know, and I think they exemplify how everybody's path through recovery can be different. And that it underscores for me the importance that we not judge people who are going through recovery or who are in an active addiction, because it is a very human struggle. And, you know, as I reflect on all the work that we're doing and all the work that we have yet to do together, I think the stories of recovery and healing give me hope.
Yeah, and I just want to follow up with you, Dr. Mendoza, from a medical perspective. A listener named Danette emailed late in the hour last hour and said, relapse does not have to be part of recovery. Many, many people put the drink or drug down until they die. She's right about that. I don't think Sean and Yana and Brandon were saying that relapse is necessary as a part of recovery or will always be part. But in the big picture of recovery, it doesn't mean the end of recovery, and it can be part of recovery. That's how I took it anyway. From a medical perspective, how did you take it?
I think that's accurate. I think everybody's path is different, and there will be people who go through recovery and never slip up and have a relapse, but I think it's important to be open to that possibility because it's a very real possibility, and for a lot of people it happens, unfortunately, repeatedly. And I think it just underscores the reality that this is a health illness, and you know, in the way that we look at diabetes and other conditions that we take care of in the medical community, you know, we know that these relapses are possible, and we want to support people whether they're before, or after, or during.
Jennifer, what did you make of the last hour?
It was amazing. I never cease to be tired of listening to Sean and Yana, and to hear Brendan's story today was amazing. These are three courageous individuals who give nothing but hope themselves, the joy of recovery. They live recovery, they exemplify recovery, and they present such a welcoming face to the community.
Sheriff Baxter, I know you've gotten to know many folks. In fact, I saw you at the 5K for Recovery Fitness, and Dr. Mendoza as well. And I know you know them well by now. You've heard their stories, but
sure.
I know they're important to you in the line of work that you have, letting people know that it's not just law enforcement, it's the possibility of recovery.
Right. And, you know, to answer your question, I heard hope. You know, there's hope in the middle of this despair that's out there in our community, and the frustration and the anger and the lack of that word hope. You know, you heard their testimonies to say there's hope. You know, even if we fall, we're going to fall forward, as Sean said. And, you know, when you got someone that's like Sean Smith saying, I'm able to fall and get back up, any of us can do it. That's the word hope. That's what I heard out of that.
All three of our guests this hour have different work that they do for the community, and in particular in the opioid crisis. And I'd like them to give kind of a snapshot of how they're seeing it. I'll start with Sheriff Baxter. You know, certainly you entered this office declaring your intention to be as as strong as you possibly can in your department regarding opioids. Nobody can wipe it out in one day.
Oh, absolutely.
How do you see the progress being made? How do you view it from your perspective in law enforcement?
Well, we did that. We redeployed, almost 8 officers. We formed a task force to supplement or augment the current narcotics units out there. We redeployed one of our crime prevention officers to do education and work hand-in-hand with Dr. Mendoza almost weekly. We're starting new programs inside the jail. We have the best opportunity that most of the people in recovery would dream for. That's not 30-day inpatient beds. We have them for 9, 10, 11 months at a time. Let's make the best inpatient beds in Monroe County. We're very happy where we're going in law enforcement, but the statistics will never catch up, if you will, to the issue. The issue is not a law enforcement issue. Dr. Mendoza nailed it. As we all know, this is a medical issue. So we're doing our part in law enforcement. I think more importantly, I can use the bully pulpit of the sheriff's office to continue to push and continue to educate. And every time we get a chance to talk, I think that's very important for us to get out in front of people. We can arrest, we can do a lot of recovery. Recovery is a great example, so many people, but we got to prevent. The first thing we got to do is cordon this problem off like a military operation and prevent the next addict from even occurring in the next addict and next addict. So the more we get out in front of people talking boldly and saying how dangerous this is, we've had 220 deaths the year before, 196 deaths the year before. If you look at our PIN map right now, it's scary. It's scary, and it should be a little bit scary to everybody in the community. It's in every town in Monroe County. It's in every town in America. So that's the one thing we're really trying to push. Look over your shoulder, because it's right behind you. It's right behind each one of us.
Now, Sheriff, when you mentioned a PIN map, what you're describing, I think, is where the overdose deaths are happening. Mm-hmm. Does it concentrate? I think you're it sounds like you're making the point that don't expect it to only be here and not here.
Yeah, absolutely. I was on Clinton Avenue the other day, and I stopped a kid from Ontario, New York, Wayne County, and he's walking down the street like a zombie. He's got his book bag. It's just so telling, and he's got the blood dripping out of his arm. They come from all over. They might come to central locations to get the easy access to the poison, if you will, to the dope, but they're coming from all over. And some are making it back to their communities, and that's where they overdose. But the PIN map shows where they overdose. Sure, it's concentrated, in central parts of the city, but there is not a town in that PIN map year to date that has not been affected, and several have been affected by death. Hmm.
Jennifer, from your work with DePaul, mm-hmm. what's happening right now, and where do you see progress or frustration?
Mm-hmm. So a couple things. We're prevention as well, prevention from a little bit different aspect. So at NCADD, what we focus in on is community organizing, bringing the community together to collectively solve a problem. We recognized early on that this is not a simple problem. It's not going to be a simple solution. So often the media would ask, what one thing could you do? There's not one thing. There's multiple ways we can attack this problem, and to do that we needed multiple sectors involved. So that was the purpose of calling together representatives from across our community early 2016 for the Opioid Task Force of Monroe County. That still is alive and well, meeting bi-monthly. So it's really about that, bringing folks together with everyone with the same objective to increase access across the board. That's what we focus on. We early identified some of our barriers, and certainly there were multiple. We also early identified what would we like to see, and the biggest message was increase access so that not one more person needing treatment would hear the message, come back in a week, come back in a month. So we focus on prevention, treatment, and recovery resources. So it's the organizing, community education. So we've trained over, my God, at this point, several thousand people in a variety of venues. So that's working with the community education, educating families. I've got educators going into the school, joined now, too, by Dr. Mendoza, his wonderful work, and Deputy Favada, his work. So we've got multiple partners doing this. Community awareness, taking advantage of every opportunity to do longer interviews with the media, because I echo the sentiments of the report or the article you read in the earlier hour and the reaction from our 3 prior panelists. If we're only to focus on the deaths and destruction of this horrendous issue around opioids and around heroines, we're going to be a community of hopelessness and helplessness. So I've taken every opportunity to focus in on all the access to services that we now have that we didn't have 6 months ago or a year ago. They continue to expand.
Access is sometimes it's inpatient, sometimes it's outpatient services. Different people have different needs or are at different points in their process. What are the biggest needs right now? When you say you never want to see someone be told, you got to wait a week, got to wait a week.
Right.
What's it going to take in our community to get to that point where that doesn't happen?
Immediate access. Mm-hmm. And we have that through some new services. So let's focus on the person needing help. Mm-hmm. That would be access to a relatively new group, which is open access. It's not a new treatment site. It's a site where one can go and get assessed, evaluated, and a so-called bed or treatment site be identified as soon as possible available treatment site. If there's insurance barriers, those can be negotiated. If there's transportation issues, those can be helped as well. And from the opening of Open Access, which celebrated its one-year anniversary just this past August, there's been five new open access opportunities at five of our treatment providers who also have walk-in access to treatment.
Do people know about this, though? I mean, it seems to me that if I have a family member who's addicted, or if I have a friend, or if I know someone, they may not, even if they're ready, they may not know where they can go. Is that part of it?
Exactly. So getting the word out, and that's why I really appreciate opportunities like this. I wish every time the media talked about another death, another overdose, that they would pair it with the increased access. It's such a different message. It's not that we're turning a blind eye or sugarcoating what's happening around us.
Sure.
But it's not presenting any picture of help and hope if we don't accompany it with all the additional resources.
So go where
those
first?
Those are just a few.
Where would you send someone first?
Open Access.
Open Access
open
is where?
Open Access. It's at University Avenue. It's co-located with Helio Health, which is the Detox Evaluation Center.
Okay, that's a great first step, and we will stay on the subject of access throughout the hour. That's part of the questions and the work that Dr. Mendoza has to deal with. What's foremost on your mind as you deal with this?
Well, you know, I think it's very important to reflect on the fact that we've had so much good collaboration in this community. I mean, you're looking at the collaboration between the medical community, even within the medical community. I mean, you know, years ago, we would never have envisioned the two health systems getting together and working together on this very important problem, and we're seeing that right now. I think that's really a sign of hope. You know, you're seeing collaboration between sectors. You're seeing collaborations between law enforcement and medicine and the criminal justice system and the community. And I think our job together as a community is to figure out what is the role that each of us can play that can have a substantial impact on this problem. Within the medical community alone, you know, I think stigma is real. And I think part of my role, and I think it's perhaps a unique role for us here on the panel, is that, you know, one of my goals is to try to eliminate the stigma that happens within our medical system. You know, I've got colleagues who are still learning about addiction, and to try to speak in their language to help them understand that addiction is a chronic illness. And when we think about it in the same way as other chronic illnesses, then we have a model of care that we can wrap around it. And then, you know, we're not starting from ground zero. You know, we're starting from a place where in this community we've got so many interventions that are geared around how do we manage chronic illnesses, how do we prevent people from going to the ER unnecessarily, how do we keep them out of the hospital, keep them in primary care, keep them at their work and their jobs and in their communities. You know, that is the model that I'm trying to adapt to this new and very difficult problem.
Stigma within the medical community, essentially, is it because a lot of the training that people get when they are becoming doctors, this is a crisis that has kind of exploded in recent years. Maybe it wasn't part of the training, wasn't part of the education when you were back in school?
Certainly there's room for improvement. And when I was in school and in residency, we didn't have this very real problem to use as the jumping off point for learning about this very important topic. But, you know, as we learn more about it, and the people in the field have known about this for a long time, but that's not enough. We need to find a way to bring addiction into the mainstream, so to speak, of regular healthcare. And we've got a long way to go. You know, depression for many people is a mental illness that is not properly treated yet in the, you know, primary care. And we've got to find a way to integrate mental health into primary care. But the next step is to integrate substance use care into primary care as well.
When it comes to stigma, what's the possible, the risk if there is a stigma within the medical community about opioid addiction? What happens to patients in treatment?
Well, you know, the first thing we're taught is do no harm. And, you know, our job as professionals is to meet people where they are, you know, and regardless of what that is, that whatever it is that they're going through, it's to meet people where they are and to not turn them away. And if I can imagine myself in the shoes of somebody who is struggling through addiction, you know, contemplating recovery, you know, it takes a lot of courage to share what we heard earlier in the past hour with a stranger. And I take that responsibility very, very heavily. And for somebody to disclose that to a professional, we have an obligation to make sure that we hear them and listen to them and not judge them.
Okay. Listeners, if you want to call the program in our second half hour, we're going to take some questions from the audience right here in studio. And if you want to call, we can work in some of your feedback as well. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Jennifer Farringer mentioned a number of questions on access to care. One of the subjects that has come up both on past discussions on this program, emails from listeners, is insurance. You briefly mentioned insurance. Mm-hmm. How are we doing now in making sure that if I have an addiction, if I have an opioid addiction, that my insurance is not going to cut off right when I'm moving into that crucial days, because days and weeks are humongous when we're finally ready to get treatment. And we have heard stories, this is not my expertise, but we've heard stories of, well, insurance only covers X, or insurance won't help with this. Is that changing? Is that getting any better?
I think it's getting better, but I don't think it's gone away. So I think our goal needs to be 100% parity. We need to get to a point. So parity is a federal, it was passed a couple years ago for both addiction and mental health. Yet parity as a reality, we have not realized. And we won't have realized until everyone is treated equally in terms of access, in terms of insurance, in terms of no more stigma. So has it gotten better? I think so. Do I still hear stories? Yes, I still do. So what can someone do? Certainly the Attorney General, State of New York, wants to hear about it, as well as legal counsel OASIS, so that they can further reach out and try to eliminate and work on any remaining insurance barriers.
And Dr. Mendoza, from your perspective, both as a doctor and overseeing county public health, how do you feel about that particular issue, making sure people understand if you need that help, you're going to get it, you're going to get that treatment, and if it's expensive, it may be covered? I mean, how is that playing out right now?
Well, that's why I think the issue of stigma is so important, because, you know, I think most of my colleagues in medicine, when we see somebody who is struggling with insurance coverage and they present to us with an issue about cancer or high blood pressure or diabetes, we wouldn't hesitate to do whatever we had to bend whatever rules we needed to get that person help. And I think we ought to be doing the same thing for people struggling through addiction. But if we have the stigma that somehow addiction is a different condition that warrants different levels of attention, I think we're only shooting ourselves in the foot. You know, we've got to find a way as a community to view addiction in the same light. And once we do, you know, we'll open up those doors. And trust me, there are many doors that are still closed to many people in our community, whether it's for cancer or addiction or high blood pressure. But once we break that threshold into thinking of addiction in the same light, to the extent that it's applicable in healthcare, I think we'll open up more doors.
Now, when it comes to the recovery process, you know, Brandon Scott's story last hour in particular, it was gripping, and I think to some it might have been surprising. This is someone who was dealing with addiction for a number of years, had periods of being in recovery without relapse that went more than a year, but ends up last year in a position where he almost died and gets sent to jail and said that it was going cold turkey almost by requirement that gave him that window to struggle through that and then find a path forward here. I don't know that works for everybody. I mean, certainly that's his perspective, and everybody is different. Medically, are we getting better at trying to figure out what it takes to start down that road, Dr. Mendoza? There's not a magic formula. There's not something that works for every single person, but are we any better at that?
It's hard to say. You know, I think everybody's path is different. And, you know, in the same way that it's hard to predict the future for any, you know, particular individual, I think it's hard to know whether we as a system are at that point where, you know, we can say that we've picked this. I don't think we're there yet. You know, I think we are still learning together as a community, and that's one of the things that I see that has been a huge improvement over, you know, a year ago, is that we're learning so many things about how we can untap the resources that we have right here in Monroe County. I see that changing things, but no, I do think we have a long way to go. And Brandon's story is powerful. What he went through was his path, and I think that worked for him. Hopefully it will continue. We, you know, support him every way we can, but that's not a path that will work for everybody. Yeah. And recognizing that everybody's path is different is critical.
Sheriff, from your perspective in law enforcement, you said earlier this hour, you can't arrest your way out of a crisis. I mean, I think everybody agrees with and understands that. How do you strike a balance between using law enforcement in a punitive way when people mm-hmm. are causing problems versus understanding that whether it's their experience in jail, their experience after they've been arrested, what it would take to get someone on a path to recovery? Because the last thing you want is to be arresting the same people time and time again.
Yeah, it's counterproductive. It does nobody any good. But you got to look at the law enforcement part of it two different ways. One, the drug dealer, right? These drug dealers are not selling cocaine, although that's horrific. They're not selling alcohol. They're not selling tobacco. They're not selling any other addictive substance. These drug dealers are selling poison. It killed 220 residents last year, right? You know, we need to pursue those people and prosecute them as much as possible. So that's one under the law enforcement. We're doing a pretty good job at that. That paradigm changed in the last 2 years, really, where it used to be an incident report. The officer would move on. The ambulance would go away with the person that was addicted, and we'd never see him again. Those are many crime scenes now where we're treating them as potential homicide prosecutions later on for the district attorney's office. The other side is the addict, you know, and our paradigm there is changing drastically right in front of us. We're getting ready to roll out with the district attorney's office Project Hope, where we have someone under arrest for criminal possession of a controlled substance, seventh, a user amount of an illicit substance. And we can give them the door A, door B option. Door A is downtown Monroe County Jail. Door B, we have these wonderful people at Open Access that are waiting for you, where the police officer can drop you there. We'll give you an appearance ticket. If you stay clean or progressively move forward for 37 straight days, and it's going to be the service providers telling law enforcement that, we'll drop the charges against you, because that's really what we want. We want you getting help. We don't want you sitting at the Monroe County Jail. And then the other part I mentioned earlier, we do have people that end up in the Monroe County Jail. Maybe their charges are too high. They were involved in other types of criminal activity, stealing from someone else, as an example. We need to be as best prepared and set up as possible for those people that are going to come in there and go cold turkey on us. That's a serious medical issue that Dr. Mendoza can talk about, especially coming from a heroin or fentanyl withdrawal. You know, we got to make sure we're 100% prepared for those people and then create the path of sobriety for them while we have them incarcerated. So many great opportunities. I mean, this is exciting. What has changed in the last few years, just in a law enforcement standpoint, the whole mindset of arrest our way out of us, not in a million years we realize that. But some people need to be arrested. Some people need to be prosecuted.
Yeah, that's for sure. On the subject of dealing, are you confident that you've got a decent handle on it? Is this sort of a whack-a-mole situation where it's difficult to track?
No, you know, we look at daily intelligence now, 24 hours. Within 24 hours of every overdose in Monroe County, we've already analyzed the intelligence. We've already looked at cell phone data. We've already looked at for packagings, and if the packaging is the same packaging we're seeing in Wayne County, in Livingston County, and maybe in the town of Webster. You know, we're looking at the commonality. And with the task force model, we're pursuing those guys and gals, with the district attorney's office now prosecuting these cases. I think she has 8 cases either. She's got convictions on 2 or 3 already, and she's got 4 or 5 waiting in the queue for homicide charges. So I think we're going in the right direction. It's a lot of work to make one of these, an overdose case, into a homicide case later on. But the work is being done by all law enforcement across Monroe County. This is not the sheriff's department, city police department. Every town is engaged in the same mindset.
And an email from a listener named Matt talked about losing a friend, not just to an overdose, but he said, I haven't heard the word fentanyl mentioned this hour. Mm-hmm. So what I don't know is how often we're seeing heroin cut with fentanyl. I guess I'll turn to Jennifer and Dr. Mendoza for sort of a description of what Matt is talking about. And Matt, we're certainly sorry to hear that. But why don't we make sure we understand what we're talking about when we talk about fentanyl and how it plays in here.
Right. So fentanyl is an extremely strong synthetic opioid, many, many more times stronger than heroin. So the issue here, it was interesting when we were following the data from the Monroe County Medical Examiner's Office, we were starting to see a downward trend until 2016. What happened in 2016 was the introduction of fentanyl into the community, and that's only increased by percentages. So when you look at the ME data and you look at the percentage of deaths caused specifically by the inclusion of heroin, it's gone up to the point of, I believe, we're over 90% now. It's not only cut with heroin, it also can be cut with marijuana, can be cut with cocaine. It's sometimes cut with the lookalike drugs. But fentanyl is a culprit here. So is in spite of all that we're doing, that we're really moving forward with prevention, treatment, and recovery services, fentanyl has been a game changer in terms of the immediacy of the death. So the first time...
If I'm a dealer, why am I cutting it at all?
I know. So this is really the question everybody asks. So why would you kill off your clients, right? You know, as if you're a dealer. But the person that's using hears that message very differently. So originally you think that, gee, let's put out a message to the community. There's some really bad stuff here because it's cut with more and more fentanyl. But someone that's using hears that message very differently. They go, this must be really good stuff, so let me go get some of that, because that won't hit me the same way. I won't experience a fatality. I'll just experience a higher. So you hear the message differently.
Okay. And Dr. Mendoza, I know you've talked about just how much of a disaster fentanyl can be here. If I could, I'll just read a few statistics and I'll let you weigh in on that. I think as we mentioned, 220 people in Monroe County died from an overdose in 2017. That's the number. Sheriff, I think you mentioned the year before it was like 190?
196.
Mm-hmm. 196. The median age was 38 years old, but the ages ranged from 20 to 82. The report says heroin, fentanyl, and its analogs, alcohol and cocaine, often are found together in a person who has overdosed. And Dr. Mendoza, in a separate interview, you said that in 90% of the cases, if people are mixing X and Y, X or Y is fentanyl. And you don't necessarily know it, though. Tell me a little bit more about your concern there.
Well, that's the problem. You know, we are entrusting, you know, for lack of a better word, the future of these individuals to people who really have no regard for their well-being. And if I'm a dealer, I want to continue my business and continue to supply. And the person who's struggling is just using drugs to feel normal. You know, we're taught in medical school that you can't die from opioid withdrawal. And, you know, chemically that's true, but we know in practice that is not true. It is so severe for people who are going through it that some commit suicide. And that is the gravity of what we're dealing with withdrawal. And so when people are struggling through this illness, they will do whatever they possibly can. And Brandon's example earlier of seeing the gas tank on empty and going further, you know, people who are struggling through addiction are doing the same thing. They're just trying to coast by and do what they can. And we need to, you know, that's why collaboration with law enforcement is so important. You know, we can't solve this one from the safety of a hospital or a clinic.
Is there a general estimate that law enforcement or the crime lab or analysts have that for every deck of heroin, if that's the term, that we see on the streets here, what percentage for every 100 decks, how many are cut with fentanyl? I mean, is it half? Is it more?
No, it's we're finding decks of cocaine or decks of what we'd think heroin. We field test them on the road. Uh-huh. Some of them are not showing a lick of heroin in the bag. You know, so we have fentanyl and we have other cut products in there.
Wow.
It's profit margin. You know, they're making a profit on it. The fentanyl is way cheaper and you get a better profit margin. And then you cut it with other stuff. And then just last week, you know, the ebb and flow of it, the heroin task force took all heroin off the streets, you know, so that's the Russian roulette people are playing. They don't know what they're buying. They don't know who's producing this. As the doctor said, there's someone at the other end of this manufacturing scheme that doesn't give a lick about them and would kill them in a second. Mm-hmm. And people in that addictive state are not hearing that reasonable talk that we find is like, that's common sense. Why would you play that game? Mm-hmm. But the point we're making is, you know, we're testing bags on the street that there's no heroin in the bag.
Wow. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, among the more than 72,000 drug overdose deaths estimated in 2017, the sharpest increase occurred among deaths related to fentanyl and fentanyl analogs, with nearly 30,000 overdose deaths in that category. So once again, the email from Matt. I appreciate that email, Matt. That's important. And again, sorry for your loss. If you want to email the program, it's connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program in our second half hour, 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. After our only break of the hour, we're going to come back and we'll have questions if our studio audience here wants to come to the mic and with questions for Sheriff Todd Baxter of Monroe County, who is with us here in studio. Dr. Michael Mendoza is Monroe County Commissioner of Public Health, and Jennifer Farringer, Director of DePaul's National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence in the Rochester area. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're back with this live edition that you can find on Facebook Live on the WXXI News page and right here on WXXI. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, the Buffalo News editorial team says it is time for Western New York to get ready to spend a lot when it comes to taxpayer money to keep the Buffalo Bills and build them a new stadium. Do you agree? What is the proper price tag for taxpayers to foot for the Bills? Then second hour, the Landmark Society's annual Five to Revive list. We reveal it. Talk with you on Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Again, we're on Facebook Live on the WXXI News page, and we're at WXXI today, but we're downstairs in our television studios. We've got a live audience here, and we're going to turn now to the microphone. So right here on the microphone, please state your name and go ahead with your comment or question.
Thank you for this very important program. My name is Scott, and Dr. Mendoza, you said something that really resonated with me. You said that the goal of medicine is firstly, do no harm. We hear that as being the hallmark of medicine all the way around. And we've heard from the sheriff about these dealers who are really very nefarious and so forth. The piece we have not heard about in this particular segment is the medical industry, Brandon's story, that his path to opioid addiction was initiated in the medical establishment, initiated with opioid prescribed pain medication. And so many people are victim to the overuse of prescription opioids and the medical industry that profits from it. What do we do about that?
Thanks for your question. You're absolutely right. You know, and I think it's important wherever I go to speak to an audience that I acknowledge that as a physician, as a member of the medical community, that we played a very important role, unfortunately, in the genesis of this crisis. And so, as I see it, you know, one of the tenets of our opioid action plan is through the advisory panel that I've convened, trying to educate my colleagues on the appropriate treatment of pain. You know, we got into this, unfortunately, because we were trying to treat pain in a way that was, now we know, not entirely safe. And we don't want to make that mistake again. And so part of our work is to educate people about how to treat pain appropriately, because we want to acknowledge that pain is very real, too. We don't want to alienate those who struggle through chronic pain, because that's a disease unto its own. But you're absolutely right. You know, I think it's important for us in the medical community not to be defensive about this, to own what happened, acknowledge what we did to potentially contribute to the issue, and more importantly, figure out what we can do as a community. And it's unfortunately not a solution that we can own entirely, but there is a good part of it that we need to own, and that's part of my goal as the commissioner.
I know you are certainly aware of people who are on pain medication for various reasons. I think of people like my mother, and they would be very fearful of living without the possibility of using an opioid for pain. And I wonder what the message is for them, because when we've had this conversation before, in fact, we had a live broadcast where we simulcasted in Cleveland and Portland and Rochester and did the subject of pain management. There's a lot of fear out there that this is going to result in eliminating opioids entirely. But I know I see you shaking your head. I know you don't think we ought to eliminate opioids entirely for pain management. But generally speaking, do you have an idea that it ought to be a lot less in terms of prescription? We ought to try other methods first. Where do you think we're headed with this?
Well, you know, the CDC has come out with recommendations on how to more appropriately treat chronic pain with opioids. And their recommendation also is not to get rid of opioids completely. It's to think about the individual patient, think about the risks and the benefits of all of the different treatments that we're going to consider for that individual. But there is, unfortunately, no, you know, easy way to take care of an individual. And so we've got to meet that person where they are. But I definitely acknowledge that there is significant fear. And I feel it in the office when I see somebody with chronic pain. You know, they're already on eggshells because they're worried that I'm going to take away their opioids. And the reality is that, you know, we need to consider people from the standpoint of what they're going through and what their individual circumstances are.
Let me read an email from a listener named Stephanie who was in the audience today. She says, I'm so grateful to be in this audience. I'm an addict in recovery from alcohol, prescription pills, and a long-term eating disorder. I also have multiple college degrees, a successful career in business, a family, and friends around the world. My point is that addiction wears the face of everyone. It's the great equalizer. What are the opportunities for those of us in recovery to be involved in the recovery of others in the county? Can we make those resources available? That's from Stephanie. It's a great question. Jennifer, I'll turn to you on that.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, you heard the voices from Recovery Fitness. That's but one. So Recovery Fitness, become involved, work with them. CORE is another drop-in center located on West Avenue. You know, those come right to the top of my head. Certainly educate and help us work together to eliminate the stigma. Also, in a community, if you're part of a community coalition, there's school community-based coalitions in, well, for example, NCADD is through our Finger Lakes Prevention Resource Center. My three staff support 20 coalitions in the Finger Lakes region. Those are school community-based, whose focus is really to address the variety of addiction-related issues in their communities. So I would certainly say that, you know, help take the time to become trained in Narcan, have a Narcan kit available for this particular. So if you come across someone, obviously you can reduce the likelihood of a fatal overdose. And most importantly, work with us to help erase the stigma, erase the lack of true parity in our system.
Okay. A follow-up, a call from a listener named Luann in Rochester said they just wanted to follow up on what she was hearing from Dr. Mendoza. She says her daughter recently had surgery where Advil was enough, but she went home with medication that was way too strong in her estimation. And she wants to know, is that still an issue today? Do we see either overprescription in terms of, if someone, I guess, just needs Advil, and it's probably hard to know what you need at that moment, but what would you say to Luann?
It's still an issue, absolutely. And I think that's why the voice of the community is so important. Whether you're a patient or somebody in another setting, we really want to hear from you. And I would love to be challenged when a patient says to me, no, doc, I really don't want to take that medication for whatever it is. And then my response is, help me understand why. And tell me more about what you're feeling, and tell me more about what it is that's helping you to feel in that way. But no, it's absolutely still a concern. I had the opportunity to speak to the Dental Association here in Monroe County, and I reviewed the data on opioid prescribing. And as a community, the dental community prescribed less than 1% of the total opioids in this community, which by every measure seems like a good thing. But then when I dove into the data more deeply and I looked at the age breakdown from the age of 10 years to 29 years old, dentists prescribed 60% of the total opioids in this county. And the number one reason for that was wisdom tooth extraction. So for all the wisdom teeth being pulled out in this county, I would encourage everybody to have a respectful conversation with your dentist and say, is this the right treatment for me? And I think that's a conversation that we all could have with all of our individual healthcare providers.
All right. Matt, who emailed earlier, follows up to say that he thinks that someone who deals drugs that lead to death should be charged with murder. Sheriff Baxter, do you agree with Matt?
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, our penal law does not agree at this time in New York State. That's a very difficult charge to place on someone. You got to show that depraved indifference. You got to show for a murder charge, you got to show that intent. And sometimes this drug dealing goes second, third party before it ends up in a needle in someone's arm. So backtracking all that information and then putting a puzzle together that it's prosecutable, that's the key here. The hand to the district attorney that she can prosecute is very difficult. So right now we're going for the manslaughter charges, which are much easier to prosecute. Unfortunately, they're equal to usually the criminal sale of a controlled substance, or even criminal possession of a controlled substance. They're equal in weight in our penal law, but I think we're trying to also make a statement that if you take a life, we're going to charge you for taking the life of another person, in addition to the sales and the possession charges. But yeah, Matt's absolutely right. The penal law has not caught up to this epidemic. We are pushing our legislators forward on that. We're asking them for better laws for this. If you sell poison on the streets of Rochester or any other community and it kills someone, it results in the death, that should be a murder charge. We all agree.
You keep calling it poison. You're very direct about what we're talking about here.
No gray area. Yeah, I worked the streets of Rochester during the crack epidemic, you know, and that was horrific, and a lot of people died, but most of it was violence. You know, it was this is different than anything we've ever seen, and this is directly resulting in the death of people the moment they stick that needle in their arm. I mean, I can't think of a different term to put it. It's poison.
I want to bring our attention to what Monroe County has been doing, and the county executive, Cheryl Donolfo, who will be on this program later this month, has called for an opioid action plan, and there is various individuals involved with that. I know Dr. Mendoza is certainly helping lead the way with that. Where does the opioid action plan sort of stand, and how has that been rolled out so far, Doctor?
Well, you know, I think the plan is a great start, you know, and as much as hope is important, hope is not a plan. And I'm very grateful that our county executive identifies the need for a plan that is fluid. You know, when we look at this plan, I take it on the road and I solicit feedback from my colleagues. And I just had the opportunity to speak at the New York State Association of Counties meeting last week and heard some great feedback on our plan. And I also think that this community has good reason to feel blessed that we have a plan that is looking at so many different aspects of this problem. Is it to say that we're done? Absolutely not. We need to keep looking at the plan. We need to keep revisiting it. But it's important for the people out in our community to know that there are others in this community in very high leadership roles that have their back. And we're not, you know, coasting on this one. We're, you know, full on gas with this, and we're doing everything we can.
I think it would be interesting to know if you've traveled much or been on the line with other communities, just because this is a problem everywhere. This is a national epidemic, and every community is trying different things here, admirably so, desperately so in some places. And you would think that if there is somewhere where it's really working, if there's some community where, you know, you've cut the deaths by 50% in 3 years and something is happening, that we would know by now. I don't know that that's happening anywhere, is it?
Well, you know, I looked at Erie County, and Dr. Burstein's a colleague of mine. She's the Commissioner of Public Health in Erie County. And I look at what Erie County has done. They've made some great improvements. And I also know that because of the circumstances in their healthcare system, you know, they have different dynamics that they have to manage. And just because it's going to work there doesn't mean that we can copy and paste it and have it work here. And so to the extent that this is a national epidemic, it's also a local epidemic. And we've got to figure out within a given community, what are the resources that need to be mobilized to find a solution?
Okay, and on the subject of prevention, I know Jennifer Farringer wanted to talk about that. So let's talk about prevention. And the pessimistic side of me would say so much of our drug crisis has come from sort of economic despair, communities that where people are growing up where there are no longer either the job sources, the factories, the companies that there used to be, that there isn't necessarily an economic path to sustainable life in the future, that has led to hopelessness, poverty, and eventually to drugs. And until we work on some sort of an economic agenda that changes that, I don't know that we can dent the drug problem. Is that, is there some truth there? Is there, can we work within that even with those, you know, sort of those parameters?
There's some truth there, but I think this epidemic more than any has really shone the light on what is the face of the addict, what is the face of this epidemic, what does an addict look like? Look like, it could be any of us, right? It could be any of us. So it's not limited to those communities within our community, larger community that are impoverished. Certainly that's a driving force when someone has no access to insurance, to care, doesn't know about resources. But I would say that certainly impacting the burbs, the suburbs, just as much, the rural communities as much. It's across the community, you know, and that's why I say prevention, you know, in terms of marshaling our folks, our communities, through the activism around community coalitions, and that becomes even a more localized response versus the Monroe County response. So you could look at what's happening in Webster, what's happening in Fairport, what's happening in, you know, so the community coalition gives you a more pinpoint view. So yeah, I agree that that's a driving factor, but it doesn't say all. And to say that, it kind of discounts the fact that addiction impacts us all.
Okay, so in a moment, we're going to get another audience question. I want to let our listeners know that Second Opinion, which is shot right here in this studio, is covering the subject of pain management post-opioid epidemic. It's November 8th at 8:30 p.m. on WXXI-TV. November 8th, 8:30 p.m. on WXXI-TV. And just to briefly follow up on prevention, key number one then to prevention right here in our community. We've heard the sheriff say so many times, you can try to arrest your way out of this, but we've got to stop it before it begins here. Key number one is what, Jennifer?
Community education. I can't do one. It's community education at the earliest possible level, elementary, middle, high school. Don't wait till high school. Start early. Reach out to families. So we do as much work supporting the families through the chaos of this crisis. If we don't do that, we're not going to change anything going forward. And again, back to the coalitions. You know, we've got to have everything working together to solve this.
Okay, Dr. Mendoza?
You know, and I think Jennifer's referring to the impact of trauma on, health outcomes. And we know that trauma plays a huge role in the kinds of illnesses that you're describing, be it drug use, be it suicide, be it violence. And we also know that in this epidemic, trauma is not the only predictor. And we know this because when we look at the data and the people who are struggling, who are suffering, who are losing, don't fit any easy description. We cannot put the people who struggle through this illness into nice, neat buckets.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me go back to the audience now. Please state your name and go ahead.
My name is Danette. I wrote an email.
Oh, hi, Danette. That's you.
Yes, hello. Long-term recovering alcoholic, thank God. I think my question was just about answered in at what age should education in the school systems be introduced? And I wonder, when I took health class, say in fifth grade in the Greece school districts, nothing was mentioned about drugs or alcohol, be it the decade, that was occurring in. But I guess I wonder what's happening now and how old are the kids when they're first make contact with this information.
Danette, thank you. It's a really important question. Go ahead.
And I think that varies from district to district. And certainly, I say NCADD is small but mighty. So we have two educators working with several school districts, but we have other prevention programs in town as well. To answer your question, it's never too early. So the earlier, the better. Does that mean you're starting out with specific information on methamphetamine? No, perhaps not. You're starting out with healthy choices, working with kids to understand signs, symptoms, talking about healthy families, working with families in that way, too.
Yeah, I'm curious to know what you think, Dr. Mendoza, in terms of ages and what's appropriate.
Well, I think that's where we look to our collaborations with early childhood development. As a physician, somebody who sees a little kiddo in my office for 20 minutes and I see, early signs of things, I know that it is so hard to really connect with that individual in that short 20 minutes of time. And that's why, as I view public health in this community, we've got to figure out how do we make those bridges between medicine and outside of medicine, because medicine cannot solve it all. Mm-hmm. These kids that, I see that are struggling in a variety of ways, but they're as young as 1 and 2 and 3. And I see the environment that they're growing up in, and I understand that, families are just doing the best that they can, and if they make choices that are not unhealthy, it's not because they have this intention to be unhealthy.
No, but struggling, when you say 1, 2, 3 years old, struggling how?
Parents who live through violence. The impact of domestic violence is profound. The impact of violence in our community is profound. The impact of even smoking and excessive substance use in the home has a huge impact on that developing child.
Hmm. So in our final minutes, then, I just want to ask our guests to tell us their outlook here, what you think is realistic. I mean, everybody is hoping that the epidemic would be gone tomorrow. But, Sheriff, you've been in the job. You've been on the ground with this, getting your hands dirty with this, and it's a very, very big problem. What's a realistic goal for this community when it comes to the opioid crisis?
Well, I think that you take it incremental and go back to my military training, right? You got to cordon off the problem. You got to set an inner perimeter around it. And I think that's the education piece, the slowing this epidemic down and let us get our hands around it. And then the recovery beds and law enforcement and all the other systems won't be overwhelmed. We got to keep on going back to that prevention. I agree earlier. It's not, I was with a person that was a recovering addict yesterday, and she was telling me about how she taught her 4-year-old to administer Narcan. Think of the trauma in that young kid's life. We're never done. But I also want to give a sense of hope. You know, we keep statistics. We are starting to analyze the data almost instantaneously. You know, I almost feel that with all the creative mindsets and the synergy that we have in this county, I think we're plateauing. I say that with a lot of reservation. I wish I had some wood to knock on, but I'm willing to say, you know, it feels like we're getting traction. It feels like we're getting the message out. It feels like people are engaged throughout the whole community because it's in everybody's backyard, and I think people are starting to realize that, and that was the first step we had to get out.
Okay, 20 seconds. Jennifer,
oops, sorry.
I go
hopeful?
Back to access, and we've created things in this community that are totally out of the box that are now being replicated in communities across New York State. So, you know, I think, again, to echo what the sheriff said, we're using all our creative strategies. There's no idea that's a bad idea, and we're lucky to have the support of OASIS, New York State Office of Alcoholism Substance Abuse Services, who are willing to look at things outside of the box. So I'm hoping, you know, to predict down the road, it's a complex problem. It's not going to be over tomorrow. I'm hoping we're at a plateau level, but I know for a fact that we have increased services exponentially, and that's recovery, treatment, prevention across the board.
20 seconds, Dr. Mendoza.
You know, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, prevention for addiction is critically important, but right now we are facing an epidemic of overdose, and we've got to apply what we know about prevention to overdose. So learn about Narcan, do everything we can to prevent the next fatality.
4 years old, I understand the horror that some people have for talking about Narcan with kids, but whatever the case is in your community, understand it's important. Learn about Narcan, and continued good work to our guests here. Our thanks to them, and the audience can thank them now. Thank you very much for being here. Dr. Mendoza, Jennifer Farringer, Sheriff Baxter, we appreciate your expertise. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer, and all of the wonderful team that put together this live broadcast here with a studio audience, 2 hours on the opioid crisis. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful afternoon. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.